Welcome to the Firehouse Salon. I'm James King.
And I'm Ashley Polak. Welcome back. As we continue our journey learning about the madcap adventures of Howard Gossage and his Firehouse gang. And in today's issue, we are talking about Ramparts magazine. Yes, James, how did that come about? How did Howard end up as an editor? And who is Warren Hinkle?
Yeah, Warren Hinkle and Howard were effectively drinking buddies, right? And they just would set up camp on North Beach at some bar and put the world to rights. My understanding is that Howard had a sort of fatherly mentorship overview of Ramparts magazine rather than being an actual editor himself. That was obviously more Warren's terrain. Yeah. But he would bring in people like Dugman Sturmer, who became the art director of Ramparts magazine. And obviously the magazine itself evolved from being this Catholic literary journal into a political powerhouse that exposed, was one of the first publications to really come out against the war in Vietnam, exposed CIA internal surveillance of American citizens, which was obviously very controversial and illegal against the Constitution. And along that journey, it became one of the first real glossy political magazines, to its detriment because it became very expensive to produce.
Yeah.
But the artwork was nevertheless absolutely striking, and everything Howard touched, the aesthetics of something, were very important, very pleasing, very radical, and his fingerprints were all over the magazine.
Yeah, I mean, there's two key elements with Ramparts. To me, the most significant thing about Howard was his ability to see talent in other people and to enable them to be the best of themselves. As you say, the relationship was a father figure to Warren, but he gave him that support. Come into the Firehouse, what do you need? How can I help? I'll connect you with this person, we'll do that. Hence why he's the editor on the masthead, even if he wasn't diving into the CIA. So I think that's fabulous. And also, we're really pleased today that we are interviewing Peter Richardson, who wrote a fabulous book called A Bomb in Every Issue, which you should all look up.
Hi, Peter. Thanks so much for joining us on the Firehouse Salon. We've examined Howard Gossage, the Firehouse, and everyone who passed through, and his influence on what became Ramparts magazine and mentorship of Warren Hinkle. Your book is incredibly comprehensive and covers every aspect of Ramparts magazine. But maybe you could just give us a bit more information on what specifically was Howard's influence in that era and iteration of the publication.
Most of Howard Gossage's influence was registered through Warren Hinkle. The relationship between Warren and Howard Gossage was very important. So the magazine started in 1962 as a Catholic literary quarterly, very different from what it became famous for. And Warren Hinkle was originally the publicist, and he had a knack for publicity, and much of that had to do with his connection with Howard Gossage. So one of the things that Howard brought to the magazine, rather Warren brought to the magazine, was a sense of showmanship. He was a great editor, a great conceptual editor, but basically he had a very, very finely tuned sense of what the media couldn't resist. And one of his talents was the ability to take a Rampart story and turn it into something that the media had to cover in one way or another. And so he had a knack for that, and as well as many other things. But the magazine never really achieved liftoff until Warren took over as the editor. He moved the magazine from where it was, Menlo Park, which is on the peninsula down in what's now the Silicon Valley, and moved it into the middle of North Beach in San Francisco. And it became a very different kind of magazine after that. First, it stopped being a quarterly. The next move from there was it became a monthly, and they started doing more politics and current affairs. They hired Robert Scheer. Scheer had come back from Vietnam and had a kind of political analysis that became an important part of the magazine. And they also had a great art director, Dugald Sturmer. So those three, Warren, Bob Scheer, and Dugald Sturmer, were the band. But Howard Gossage was a very important part, very important influence, because of the way he understood the media. He passed along a lot of that expertise to Warren, and not just at Ramparts, but then later at Scanlon's Monthly as well.
Yeah, I like what you said about it became as a magazine, the magazine that had to be written about, and that's what elevated it. Correct me if I'm wrong, but its peak circulation was pretty impressive. It was about 500,000 at the height of its popularity.
And
It was
much of that
quite.
was newsstand, and it depended very much on getting the other media megaphones to get their message out to more readers. So they had a substantial readership, which Warren built between 1964, let's say, and 1967. But the other thing they were able to do was to get the New York Times to carry their biggest stories. These were whistleblower stories and investigative stories about CIA and about Vietnam, later about the Black Panthers. And that's how the Ramparts editors kept score, how many times the New York Times would pick up one of their stories above the fold on the front page. And Warren won that competition. He was he had a very sharp sense of finding a story, publicizing it in a way so that the other media outlets couldn't ignore it, and then playing one media outlet off the other. So there was a kind of media savvy that I think went derived from his relationship, largely from with Howard Gossage. And Warren just was very good at it too. He was a funny guy. He was very confident. He was skilled. He was hardworking. And there was just this kind of raucous energy that he brought to the magazine. He wasn't really a kind of political radical or anything like that, but he was a rebel. And I think you could say the same about Dugald Stuermer. Ramparts became known as a kind, as Warren called it, a radical slick. It was radical, its politics were radical, but largely that came from Robert Scheer and Robert Scheer's contribution to the magazines. The slick part meant that they used, the techniques of bigger outlets like Time magazine and Newsweek magazine instead of the leftist magazines with low production values and newsprint and no color and just very dull magazines. So they took the characteristics of the so-called slicks and they merged that with this kind of radical content. And they were very young. That's the other thing to point out. There was a kind of youthful irreverence that was a very important part of the magazine's success. And they had a good sense of humor, even though many of the topics were very grave when it came to Vietnam or CIA torture and in Vietnam and other kinds of CIA infiltration of student groups. These were serious matters, but there was a kind of whimsy both to the look and to the tone of the magazine that made it more appealing than a lot of their sort of grittier underground counterparts and also their stodgier leftist ones.
And the title of your book, A Bomb in Every Issue, was that, in terms of the editorial, was that the goal? Something to blow up in every issue, but balanced with that irreverence and humor.
Yeah, the funny thing about that phrase is that it came from Time magazine. Time magazine did everything it could to disparage Ramparts magazine. It saw it, it understood what Ramparts was up to, which was to take all the stuff that Time was doing successfully, but apply it to a kind of new left political agenda. And Time hated that. Time was a more center-right kind of magazine. Without really advertising that, they normalized that position. And then when Ramparts came along, they did everything they could to sink it, really. But the irony, of course, is that every time they mentioned Ramparts, all the Time readers found out about Ramparts. And the Time readership was maybe 10 or more times the size of the Ramparts readership. So it really played into Ramparts' hands in that sense. But the phrase itself, a bomb in every issue, did refer to these big blockbuster stories. But it also had a kind of insult built into it, I think, and that was, or a sense of danger. And that was that Ramparts was not just bombastic, but these were bomb throwers. These were anarchists. This was destructive of the kinds of things that Time magazine supported, probity and good governance and so on and so forth. But of course, the interesting thing is over time, we learned that Time magazine had a lot of CIA people and CIA contacts during that time. So every time there was an expose of the CIA or other parts of the national security state, Time had something to lose.
And how much did they?
Sort of salacious,
you go.
Salacious, fearless editing style. But the magazine was, it did uncover the CIA internal surveillance, which was obviously a massive constitutional sort of crisis for the USA. And that, you talk about it a bit, maybe you can expand on it a bit more, but that led Ramparts magazine itself to find itself under heavy surveillance.
So one of the things that Robert Scheer found, he found it in the library at the University of California, Berkeley. It wasn't like, it wasn't like he didn't hack into some sort of government system. These things were lying around in the library. But he found out that there was a kind of CIA operation, covert operation in Vietnam, and he reported on that. And that drew the attention of the CIA. The CIA, of course, was not supposed to spy on American citizens or anybody in the domestic area. That was illicit. Any kind of work that they did in that way was illicit. So what the CIA did was they invented a kind of reason to investigate Ramparts. The reason was that they suspected that there was some sort of foreign support for the magazine. So they invested the magazine, everybody connected to the magazine. They didn't find any such support, but that didn't keep them from continuing to play out dirty tricks against the magazine and to keep a file on the magazine. The problem with that was that too was eventually discovered and publicized. And this is all before not just the CIA, but also the FBI and other agencies, the National Security State, were subjected to a very thorough house cleaning. Until that time, very few Americans outside of government, for sure, understood what the FBI was really doing or what CIA was doing. And so those agencies had really just been, in many cases, not even really reporting to Congress on their activities. So this was real. This was important stuff in the mid-1960s for a bunch of 20-year-olds, and I think Warren may have been 30 by this time, to happen upon and report. And part of this, I think, has to do with the fact that it was based in San Francisco, Ramparts Magazine, that is. They weren't in the corridors of power. They weren't trying to get sources and cultivate sources, and they were just flying in with what they had, and not too worried about the consequences. I think for beat writers, beat reporters who have to report on government agencies or the White House or whatever, they have to go back there. And Ramparts didn't. They were going to move on to the next thing. And I think in many ways, and two people who started Rolling Stone magazine worked at Ramparts. And I think they carried on in many ways that same tradition. So did Mother Jones. The three people who started Mother Jones were also working for Ramparts magazine. So Ramparts in many ways was a kind of point of origin for a lot of this kind of reporting, much of which was done under the auspices of different magazines and organizations. One of them is still around, the Center for Investigative Reporting, which was started in the mid-1970s. Of course, Mother Jones and Rolling Stone are still around as well.
And they, in terms of the trouble they got into, you talk about, I think, in your book about their phones being tapped and being tracked, but obviously they weren't being funded by a foreign power. Did they see them as rebels? What's the word I'm looking for? I think in the Anguilla story, which was covered, I think, in Ramparts, I think they were all described as these pesky San Franciscans meddling in affairs. Were they seen as annoying but not dangerous, or... like, was there any information revealed at a later date in how they were tracked and how they were considered?
Yes. We do know that CIA was investigating them illicitly, as mentioned earlier. The FBI was tapping their phones without a doubt. And we know that because a former FBI person joined the staff. And he said, oh yeah, I used to, he went to a party with Jessica Mitford, who was on the editorial board of the magazine. It's like a cocktail party. And he said, oh, we've met before. And she goes, no, I'm quite sure we've never met before. No, I'm positive. I don't see how that could be. In fact, he had been tapping her phone. He knew everything about her and her family and everything else.
Right.
That's another, that wasn't paranoia. The Ramparts people were being surveilled And they were very aware of that. They also discouraged smoking pot in the office for exactly that reason. They didn't, of course, they didn't care if people smoked pot, but the idea that they could be compromised somehow by law enforcement because of that, for smoke pot on your own time, I think
And yet they
was the
still let
message.
Hunter S. Thompson into the office. You describe a pretty fun episode in the book about how Warren Hinkle's that sort of office pet chimpanzee gets into Hunter S. Thompson's bag and ends up eating a bunch of his drugs and he's chasing it around.
Yeah, Warren and Hunter Thompson were quite close, and they remained close even after Warren left Ramparts. In fact, Warren published the first examples of ganja journalism at Scanlan's. And although, of course, Thompson ended up moving on to Rolling Stone after Scanlan's shut down after 8 issues. But he can't, at that time, Hunter Thompson was still living in San Francisco. He'd written this book about the Hells Angels. Ramparts magazine had reviewed the book in the magazine, and Thompson decided to stop by. He had a lot of respect for what Ramparts was doing, politically, especially as his own writing became more and more focused on politics and current affairs. But he brought his backpack and into the office. They left it in the office and went out for some drinks. And drinking with Warren, as with Hunter Thompson, was a pretty serious commitment. Anyway, they came back after a long lunch, and the backpack was open. Thompson's pills were strewn all over the floor, and the office capuchin monkey, who was named after the founder of Time magazine, was just circulating at top speed around all the tops of the cubicles, and it was obvious that the monkey had gotten into Thompson's dexedrine, probably. And I think he had to have a stomach pump. But Thompson was completely, Thompson wanted the death penalty for this monkey. Anybody that would steal his drugs was not worth keeping around in the office. So that was the beginning of a long friendship between those two. And again, Warren would midwife gonzo journalism. First of all, he paired him with the illustrator Ralph Steadman, which turned out to be very important. And because Steadman's illustrations were indispensable or kind of part and parcel of the whole Gonzo franchise, that was Warren. And of course, that first big story was the Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved. Thompson was from Louisville originally and did a kind of scathing satire of his hometown. And then the illustrations really, in many ways, I think, set it off. Thompson was very unhappy, actually, with the story that he had submitted to Warren. He thought it was the end of his career, actually. And then he was so surprised when, especially when combined with these illustrations, he was getting all these letters and calls of congratulation. And he said later that he felt like he had fallen down an elevator shaft and landed in a pool full of mermaids. Because it really was the beginning of this whole franchise that became part of his signature style, but then it became his meal ticket for the rest of his career.
You talked about what the magazine led to, Mother Jones and Rolling Stone, and what came before this? Had this ever been done before, or were they stepping into new territory?
It hadn't been done in certainly it hadn't been done in San Francisco. Warren really identified with these kind of bohemian journalists of the 19th century, and there had been some muckraking, but that was many decades before Ramparts came along, and the muckraking tradition had basically been dormant in American journalism during this time. The Nation magazine under Kerry McWilliams was doing a pretty good job on limited resources. That they had a couple tricks for doing it. One was to devote an entire issue to one story, and then the guy who wrote that story would spin it off into a book and make it more worthwhile for him, because the Nation magazine was paying people like $100 a piece, including Hunter S. Thompson's first piece, or one of his first pieces for the Nation magazine, which was on the Hells Angels. Then he could spin it out into a book and make it work financially. But that tradition was pretty dormant. The mainstream outlets were basically pretty flat-footed and not really pressing the government on things like the war in Vietnam, or later the war on drugs, or you really needed to get something, a smaller, scrappier player to do these stories. Once the stories hit, then the Washington Post would pick it up or the New York Times would pick it up. In many cases, they would follow up very effectively. And I think what that shows is that to have a kind of healthy media ecology, you need these kind of smaller, scrappier players, and then these bigger outlets that get it out to more people. But if you're relying on the bigger outlets, they miss a lot of stories. And for reasons that a lot of people have analyzed in some detail, one of them was Hunter Thompson's assistant at Rolling Stone magazine, Tim Krause, who wrote The Boys on the Bus about the 1972 presidential campaign and the kind of sociology of the campaign press corps. And so for a full analysis of that, we have it going back as early as 1972. But the same dynamic, I think, can still exist today. You really need somebody more irreverent or impertinent or scrappier or more tenacious, somebody with an axe to grind in some cases, or somebody whistleblower with a story to tell to get some of these stories out to light. And Ramparts was great at that. And they influenced a lot of other outlets too. A lot of other young people during this time looked at Ramparts and just thought, that's possible. I can imagine doing that kind of work now. And a lot of journalism, a lot of good journalism came out of that example. The problem for Ramparts, of course, was that political magazines then and now don't make any money. Nobody wants to advertise in them. So even if they're reaching a lot of people through circulation, that doesn't really pay for all the work that has to be done to gather that news and do it properly and get it out to people. So Ramparts, as Howard Gossage pointed out, Ramparts was a kind of 24-hour crap game when it came to its finances. Warren was great at raising money, selling people on the excitement of being involved with Ramparts and the stories it was doing. He was going around to rich people and just basically asking them for their support, which he got. When he left, Ramparts lost that ability and it just began to lose altitude very quickly. And it eventually became edited by David Horowitz and Peter Collier. This is back when they, of course, were on the staff when Warren and Bob Scheer were there. And then later, of course, they begin this kind of long march to the right wing. And Horowitz now is probably best known as being Stephen Miller's mentor.
Yeah, he had quite a transformation. It's interesting just thinking about Howard had very strong views on magazines. He was very much, again, the irony not lost on anyone, him himself being an admin, he was very much in favor of reducing advertising in magazines or getting rid of it altogether and then charging readers as much as the publication cost so that it could turn a profit based solely off charging people. And that never really was viable as a going concern. But it feels like today, with Substack and Patreon, that's become the preferred mode of reception for a lot of people. You pay a small fee because obviously the costs of producing a website or a newsletter are minimal, and those people can actually make a decent living. There's a great entertainment industry publication called The Ankler that's just entirely subscription-based and is one of the fastest growing and most comprehensive outlets now, and certainly the most respected because it has no has minimal advertising and can be pretty fearless in what it says.
I know the British experience is a little bit different. We don't have anything like the BBC or the tax that supports it, but we used to have something very similar in the United States going back to the 19th century. I guess the main point is historically in the United States anyway, readers have never paid the real price of what it takes to put this stuff together. There's a lot of different ways to keep it afloat, but one of the things is to bundle political news, which is the only news the founding fathers cared about. The First Amendment is not about celebrity news or sports or anything like that. At the founding of the nation, really, there was huge support from the government, indirect in many ways, for journalism. The government took out ads. The government gave preferential mailing rates. In fact, the mail was free for newspapers in their own counties for many years. And some media people have done the calculations and brought it into current dollars. If we spent now those subsidies that I just mentioned, those and others, if we spent it that in real terms in today's dollars, it would be something. The public support now in the United States for all public media is about, I think it's about $600 million a year. And we spend more on military bands every year. I mean, that's a rounding error in the Pentagon budget. So, and we spend more actually on Voice of America type stuff. In other words, we spend more taxpayer money on pushing out American media to people around the world, not anybody in America. We can't get that. We can't get that stuff in America. So, but if you put it all together, the 19th century subsidies for newspapers mostly, it would be something in the area of $35 billion a year, which I think is about the BBC's budget, or rather, maybe I've got that wrong, but it comes closer per capita to what England spends on those subsidies rather. Warren knew that. Howard Gossage knew that. We all knew that advertising subsidized newspapering and magazines in a way that made it subject to the vagaries of the marketplace. And now, of course, that model is completely broken. Since Ramparts came along, all the advertising migrated over to online advertising. And now none of the newspapers, or very few of the newspapers, and very few of the magazines can make the old model work with the way advertising works. So by pinning it to advertising, and then everybody thought that was normal. That was just the way of the world, that advertising, of course, would subsidize all this stuff that we need. That went away, and it's not coming back. That's the other thing to emphasize, I think, to people who follow this stuff, is that if you're waiting for a tech solution to the problem that high tech presented to journalism in America, the cavalry's not coming. So we've got to figure out a different way to do it. And a lot of people are saying, if you think of political journalism as a public good, like infrastructure or law enforcement or something like that, and certainly the founding fathers thought that, then you got to subsidize it with public money, one way or another. And we haven't gotten there. You know, we spend a pittance on that. And we get Fox News and clickbait, and a lot of bad journalism.
Yeah.
In the UK, the politicians do not like the BBC because it holds them up to account. And so I can see how, particularly in the coming years, that might be a tough sell trying to get.
It's a tough sell to the journalists too in this country. Yeah. They think, how are we supposed to report on the government if that's who's paying for us? And my response to that is, how do you report on multinational corporations now? Because that's who's funding you now. And they don't sense any conflict there. But when the government's involved, I think it's a different matter. So I think we have to catch up a little bit with the way we're thinking about this. Obviously, a lot of other countries figured this out a long time ago and have been supporting. Germany, for example, a huge supporter of public media, radio, television, and other things. Maybe we'll get there. But at the moment, I think we're still struggling with what Howard Gossage and Warren Hinkle knew more than 50 years ago.
I think in this series, we've been trying to pick apart the learnings from the past and the relevance to the present and the future. So you said the cavalry's not coming. Is there any kind of good news in there of how, or a kind of path of how things could be disrupted? James talked about within his sector, within his industry, like who are the Rampart voices today? Is there a path to change that? Or has the internet, has social media separated everyone off into these separate groups and it's hard to do the same thing?
It does seem a bit disintegrated now, or even kaleidoscopic, just where you get your information, how you get it. Is it accurate? Is it reliable? I think we're going through a very tough patch right now. I think there's not a lot of trust in the big outlet compared to the past. And nevertheless, we do still have some big outlets. And that interplay that we were talking about earlier, I think, is very important. I've I like the Substack model. If you have one or two or 12 people that you want to follow and it's $5 a month, that's a pretty good deal. I think, though, probably what you're going to end up getting is a lot of opinion and analysis instead of a lot of news gathering, which I think a lot of the Substack people and other bloggers rely upon and dance on top of. Again, I like having the small players and then the bigger ones. I'm mostly concerned about the bigger ones now. There are a lot of very talented writers out there that are worth reading and following. And some of them are being compensated quite well. One who comes to mind is Matt Taibbi, who used to write for Rolling Stone, now has a Substack, but there are many others. And it ends up paying them a lot better than the magazines used to,
It's
which I
quite
think is fine.
an overwhelming landscape, isn't it? There's something about the 60s and what was going on there. Like my question about had people done this before when Ramparts came along? There was a lot of firsts then, right? And things were.
Yeah, and a lot was cooking right here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And that's an important thing to point out. One of the things that Ramparts reported on, not favorably, was the San Francisco counterculture. Warren wrote a piece just before the Summer of Love that was quite disparaging. And that he wasn't unique. Most of the coverage, and there was a lot of it in 1967, was dismissive. Time magazine was in there, Newsweek magazine was in there, Life magazine, all the networks. Everybody sent somebody to San Francisco and put a mic in front of a hippie's face and asked him or her why they dress like that or how many drugs they took that day or whatever. Now, Warren was more sophisticated than that, but he didn't, again, he wasn't a hippie. He wasn't even really a radical. And so his coverage, I think, ended up prefiguring a lot of the other negative coverage. Joan Didion came to town and did a negative piece. Hunter Thompson did a kind of mixed piece for the New York Times Magazine. That was cooking the San Francisco counterculture. Over in, you have the rise of the Black Panther Party. And Ramparts was very connected to the Black Panther Party, in part because they hired Eldridge Cleaver. In fact, got him out of prison, offered him a job, which was a condition for his release from prison. And he wrote for Ramparts for a short time and then became the Minister of Information for the Black Panther Party. And Ramparts continued to report on the Black Panthers. And then in Berkeley, you had all the campus activism, which Bob Scheer and others, there were a lot of Berkeley students who ended up, or Berkeley people who ended up writing for Ramparts as well. And for a short time, Ramparts had its editorial offices in Berkeley. David Horowitz was a Berkeley grad student. Peter Collier was a Berkeley grad student. Bob Scheer had gone to graduate school at Berkeley. Adam Hochschild, who later founded Mother Jones magazine, was also a Berkeley guy. Those three points on the triangle, really, what was happening in Berkeley, what was happening in Oakland, and what was happening in San Francisco, was a really rich stew to draw on and attracted a lot of national attention. All of those were stories, but Ramparts was well positioned to report on all of them and with some style and insight.
On my journey with Gossage, I was always hunting for stuff about Howard in all of these frameworks. The Rampart story about Anguilla that Warren gave me. I'm just wondering, I'm assuming you've read a lot of the magazine and your research. If there's a story in there that you really loved or that sort of stood out for you that wasn't Vietnam or CIA or was unexpectedly humorous or irreverent or interesting, any gems we should be trying to look up? And also, just more pragmatically, but is there an archive of all of this? Like, where would you go and do more research?
There are online archives now that you can access, and Alexander Street has it. I think that's behind a firewall. There's also UNS, which has everything online, sometimes a little hard to read. And a lot of libraries have the full run. Remember, they only went from 64 to 75 or so, or 62 to 75. And for most of that time, it was a monthly, and part of it was a quarterly. So there aren't, it's not an infinite amount of material, and some of the libraries have all of it. I think as far as the story goes, that the thing that it's very revealing actually about Ramparts magazine, especially under Warren Hinkle, and that is they did a review of a fake book on the Kennedy assassination. And Warren credited a lot of the Kennedy conspiracy stories. And I don't mean to be dismissive by calling them conspiracies. I just mean maybe there was a conspiracy. But they did this review of a fake book, and the media, the other mainstream media outlets, reported on it as if it was completely legitimate. And they began footnoting this fake book and so on. And what it was such a perfect thing for Ramparts, partly because it was funny. There was a they a lot of what they were doing, in addition to reporting stories, was they were a kind of media critic. They were looking both ways. They were looking at the things that the media was reporting on, but they were also looking at the way the media worked, and especially the kind of flat-footed media, this kind of just on robotic, mindlessly neutral in many cases, lazy. That was the kind of joke that Warren loved. And when I finally asked him, I finally caught up with him personally when I was researching the book. It was in Los Angeles, and he was at the bar at the Staples Center downtown. It was a big book exhibit, trade book exhibition. And I said, why do you think Ramparts was so successful? And he said, it's probably because the rest of the press was so shitty. And he really believed that. It was a perfect question to polish up his own apples. He could have gone on for 5 minutes and it would have been great explaining why they were so good at this or that or the other thing. And instead, the comment that came to his mind first and no filter was, I'm not sure we were that good. I just think the rest of the press was really bad. And so I think that was the other thing. And the readers picked up on that. The readers felt like, hey, this is that I can trust this place because they're going to tell me about where the rest of the media is falling down on the job. And so, and Tom Hunter Thompson ends up making that a big part of his work, just this always reporting, but also doing the media criticism at the same time. I think the problem is a New York Times reporter has pointed out to me is what if everybody's a media critic and nobody trusts, the big outlets anymore, even when they're doing their jobs properly. And I think we're a little bit closer to that state of affairs now, where the media, if certainly has not been perfect, even on reporting some of the big stories of this century, like the invasion of Iraq, they whiffed on that, or the global economic meltdown in 2008. Where were all why weren't people screaming this from the rooftops before this all happened? So in many cases, there are some good reasons for skepticism about the big outlets, but I still am a little bit worried, that when they don't exist at all and all we've got is, people in their pajamas down in the basement, that makes me very nervous.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Peter. I'm interested, how long ago did you write the book, and what are you working on now?
I wrote the book in two it came out in 2009. And it was the feedback that I got on it made me want to follow up on that. My next book actually was on the Grateful Dead, which was part of that scene during that same time, not political journalism, but certainly the San Francisco counterculture. Then I wrote a book on Hunter Thompson that came out almost 2 years ago, 2 years ago. And now I'm working on a book on the first decade of Rolling Stone magazine, the years that the magazine was in San Francisco. And of course, as I mentioned, that the co-founders originally worked at Ramparts magazine, and I think they inherited a lot of that. And they solved a lot of Ramparts problems in part because they had advertisers, the music business.
Yes.
And with that advertising money, they could sprinkle in some big political stories. They were always more than a rock magazine, but they didn't have to depend on their political coverage to pay the bills. They had this back in the day. Not anymore. That world has completely changed as well. But during the first 10 years, and then for a little bit after that, Rolling Stone was a big player in how people got information about records and what to buy. And they attracted a lot of advertising. So I think Rolling Stone, even though they weren't probably as notable as the for muckraking and investigative reporting as Ramparts was, they're still around and they're still doing it, some of it, and they did some major stories over those years as well. So I'm very interested in the similarities and differences there between Ramparts and Rolling Stone.
Yes, amazing. Thank you so much for your time.